It's Ian Pickus. We're back in the Congressional Corner today with New York Congressman Paul Tonko. He's a Democrat from the 20th District in office since 2009. Congressman Tonko, welcome back.
Thank you, Ian. Always a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
You know, it's been a few weeks since we've checked in with you. And in fact, in that time, the so-called Big Beautiful Bill passed the House of Representatives by one vote. As we speak, it's being conferenced with the Senate. You were a no vote on that package, and I was wondering why.
Well, there's a lot of damage and consequence in this bill. You know, to label it beautiful is inaccurate. It's a very negative, ugly outcome for so many people. The impact on 16 million people losing their health care insurance, for starters, is a really tough outcome. The threat to both the Medicare and Medicaid revenue streams for our hospitals, many of our rural hospitals especially, is a significant one. If you're cutting $800 billion out of Medicaid and $500 billion out of Medicare, you can't help but impact the access and affordability for many for health care. So that whole arena, the fact that they're going to charge the poorest to pay $35 as they go to each and every clinic visit or doctor visit, there are just so many egregious components in that bill. The other is the nutrition impact. The hunger awareness, hunger assistance programs are just incredibly impacted by this budget. And it's really a huge setback of some $330 billion worth of cuts nationally to these programs. That means a lot of denial for children, for seniors, for the disabled with food nutrition programs, which are very much a part of wellness and prevention for a number of people who have chronic illnesses. So that one is painful also. And there's just a lot of setback with clawing back on a lot of the innovation, clean energy economy, rebates and incentives and production tax credits, investment tax credits that enabled many in the manufacturing arena and many in the innovation and clean energy concepts, which were driving a lot of new jobs, significant paying jobs, are devastated by this budget, as are research programs. Basic research on, for instance, Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or many, many of the diseases, NIH is severely negatively impacted. So, there are just a host of things that really make this an unacceptable budget for the people of the 20th Congressional District. And I would say there isn't a district in the country, a congressional district, that doesn't fare poorly with the outcome of this plan. Now, the math that they got was with some people not voting and others who, just didn't support the measure, and that measure, that bill, the big beautiful, termed now the big ugly by many of us, passed by just a single vote. So that tells you that some of the math games were played, and some of the a number of the people were upset with the final package that left here to go to the Senate.
Now, what would you say to the argument that Republicans have made, including the House Speaker, that Democrats aren't telling the truth about the cuts to programs like Medicare and Medicaid in this big, beautiful bill?
Well, I've seen some of their rhetoric. I've heard some of their rhetoric, and it's amazing. They want people to believe that all of the people taken off of health care are illegal immigrants. And I can tell you that is far from the truth. I think it's around 1% of the New York population, for instance, that might be in that category. The gross amount of people are individuals who require Medicaid for their health care. In this district alone, in the 20th Congressional District, in round numbers, it's about 28,000 that lose their health care. So they're simply not telling the facts as they are. They're trying to suggest suggest that a certain population had their health care taken from them, when in fact they're not being frank and truthful with the American public.
What about the question of work requirements to receive a program like SNAP, which is another part of this? Why is that so bad?
Well, you know, basically, when it comes to Medicaid eligibility or for SNAP programs, many of the people are working. And some of the states that have tried work requirements, for instance, for Medicaid, in Arkansas and Georgia specifically, the effort failed and failed miserably. The onerous attempt to have people fill out forms showed that in many cases the states were losing some of the forms. People were overwhelmed with the forms. Some didn't have computers by which to access to do some of the forms. Others were, you know, perhaps illiteracy there. But the fact of the matter is the gross many of people, overwhelming number of people on Medicaid are working. Some are working two jobs. And I think it's the onerous quality of imposing that kind of restriction that is done simply to get people off the rolls. And, you know, some of the requirements, if you're 58, 60, 62 years old, and you're looking to get work, it's difficult. Many people tell me that, they don't fare well in their attempts to work because of age. And there are others that are home tending to children or to aging parents. You can have them go to work, but then those individuals for whom they're caring are going to end up in institutional settings. So it requires a full framing of the issue, not just a narrow perspective. And basically here, it's been proven quite significantly that these work requirements, which sound really good, are really onerous and really take a lot of people who are eligible for Medicaid or for nutrition programs off of those roles simply because of the onerous quality.
Now, we're speaking at a time when, as I said, the bill is still being negotiated between Republicans who control the Senate and the House, but President Trump wants it passed by July 4th. We'll see if that's even feasible. Do you expect that the Senate will make significant changes to what the House already approved?
Well, I think they are. I think so far the news has been that they're adding to the painful Medicaid cuts in the Senate. So that makes that consequence even grosser. But I think their approach is to borrow less than the House version had. You know, when you're borrowing $5 trillion to give a tax cut to the very wealthy, to billionaires, and cutting programs, it simply makes no sense. You know, the good news here is, and I'll share good news to my colleagues and to the general public, we could have programs that are improved. We can address our deficit. We can bring stability to our economy if we simply don't choose to do the tax cut for billionaires. And I don't know why we're not following that path. This is causing so much damage to the great many of us who require programs, require assistance, hospitals that need these revenue streams, you know, the services that are going to be impacted. That could all be avoided if we chose just to drop that desire to do a billionaire tax cut. And, you know, the great many of us, rather than the few who are getting the benefit, the great many of us are suffering the consequences.
What's the message that you've been getting from constituents and residents?
Well, certainly the message at these town halls has been one of pushback. They do not want these cuts. So many people have come talking about the Medicaid, Medicare impact and what that means to their family situation. Many have come talking about, some of the impact on health care, reproductive care for women. Many have talked about the impact on nutrition programs, on local governments, asking the states to provide, like they never had before since the 60s with these nutrition programs, to have some skin in the game. And I think it amounts to a 19 million across the country. So these are impacts on the states that are going to be powerful, that are first time in their nature. And, it's unnecessary. You know, this is all an exercise of pain and consequence because they want to cut programs and reduce and borrow a great amount of money. Deficit hacks or deficit hawks have turned into deficit hawks. They have forgotten their mission of chipping away at the deficit, and now they're willing to add to that deficit by borrowing trillions in order to pay for a billionaire tax cut. It makes no sense. The arithmetic here is very clear, very plain to understand. If you don't do that tax cut, you can still keep the programmatic efforts going. You could improve them for efficiency's sake with something they talked about, getting rid of waste, fraud, and inefficiency, but they never did that. They just simply cut programs pell-mell out of the budget and with no improvements. They just quit them. Well, that's not efficiency. That's denial. And they're also laying off or firing many, many federal workers who had institutional knowledge on a number of these programs. They're denying research. So, you know, people are concerned about the research impact at these town halls. They know that with our national plan for Alzheimer's and the national plan for Parkinson's that I authored and had passed in both houses and signed into law by the president is up and running, and they're through research making great strides. People are upset that they're suffocating that research portion of the of that success story. And so, you know, we're continuing to hear from so many people about the borrowing that is unnecessary simply because it's going to pay for a tax cut for billionaires. So across the board, there's various perspectives that people are really concerned about. And their request of me is, what can we do? And I think it's public information beyond belief here. We need to, it's like drinking out of a fire hose with what they're doing in this budget. There are so many things they're attacking that it's very difficult to take all of that plethora of issues and get them to the public. But we're doing that. We're doing in piecemeal fashion, feeding the most severe first, but getting all the information to the public, hoping they exchange that with their family, friends, and neighbors, and for those in other districts. Because my colleagues on the other side are not, for the most part, hosting town halls. And so their constituents mm-hmm. do not know any of the harmful consequences of these bills. So we need a huge information exchange here so that the public knows what's going on.
You know, it's philosophically interesting, Congressman Tonko. You know, we cover public polling here at the station, and by and large, especially in the Northeast, the package as it's being worked on is not popular. That being said, in November, voters gave Republicans total control of Washington, and I think there's sort of little doubt about what would be done with that power. It would look like a bill like this. So how do you square what you're hearing from constituents with the fact that the country went in a totally different direction?
Right. Well, you know, it's something that I've asked my constituents about, or the general public, if they're not constituents, just talking to the general public. And when we have these this dialogue with town halls, I want to kind of understand where they're at. And they didn't believe, some who had voted for this administration didn't believe that they would do a lot of this work. And second of all, if they were going to do it, they didn't think it would be this severe. But they're really throwing the baby out with the bath. When you cut into Medicare, Medicaid by $1.3 or $4 trillion, you can't help but affect the access and affordability of health care. And, you know, when there was a lot of struggle from a different perspective to get the Affordable Care Act passed when I was here in 09 and 10. But now I see that, you know, the people are comfortable with the health care coverage they have. They don't want it taken away. And this is everything from children with CHIPS programs for health care to veterans where Medicaid is woven into their programs. So Medicaid affects a lot of the health care outreach. And I think they're playing with fire here. And as people become aware of this, you know, I'm just thinking of all of the folks that turned out in mass on the No King weekend, where, you know, they protested all this power being concentrated in one individual, the denial of Congress to be involved. You know, we don't have interaction with the executive branch. And then he challenges the judicial branch and, you know, says that he's not going to abide. You know, and his resolve is impeach the judge rather than offer an appeal to the court. So people see this as a thirst for power, a concentration of power in one individual, and it's really what our framers of our Constitution were probably most concerned about.
Well, let me follow up on that. with respect to international affairs, because as we speak, a briefing for Congress on the U.S. role in military strikes on Iran has been postponed a bunch of times. It's still unclear whether that will happen. Do you feel that Congress has been cut out of this very important decision making about U.S. military action?
Look, I have a record of having voted on the situation in Iran. Of course, we don't want development of nuclear strength in Iran. I worked hard on the Iran nuclear agreement, which was torn up by President Trump, that caused this whole situation. But, you know, as they did the strike, people were saying it should be done in coordination with Congress. Yet another way that he snubbed Congress. And I think that now you have disagreements, like, you know, he's talking about what the folks did with the intelligence efforts in the federal government. He's disagreeing. He's saying that they obliterated all of the nuclear power with their attack. Others are saying it set back the program simply by months. So, look, if we're concerned about a buildup of nuclear power in Iran, there's a way to do it in concert with Congress and, you know, and to work on the War Powers Act, which enables us to put pressure on the administration to work with us. I mean, he declared that he would be a peacemaker, right, for his second term. He has categorically failed at every level. He claimed he would end the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, Israel and Hamas, and establish peace across the Middle East. And all accounts, he has failed. So we're asking that he consider Congress as a distinct, separate branch. He has ignored us from the start of this second term, and it's causing damage with the budget bill. It's causing damage with foreign activities, and I think the War Powers Act is something that's going to be needed so that Congress is informed, updated, and given the details of just what the strike meant. And the intelligence agency is in vast disagreement with his statements, and we know that he's someone who can really embellish the truth not really, you know, give us the accurate information. So very suspect of where we are right now, and we need that briefing.
Congressman Tonko, I was wondering, you know, you're on the Energy and Commerce Committee, and the other day Governor Hochul announced that she wants to establish a new nuclear power plant in upstate New York. What was your reaction to that?
Well, you know, I believe in all forms of clean energy, and that would include nuclear. My concern is that in the past, when those projects were initiated, they went well over budget. And so I would think that we have to be very careful to making certain that we live in accordance with the budget. And, you know, there's no denying that as we grow this economy, as was happening under the Biden administration, there is a need to address supply, energy supply. And the generation of that energy, I hope, will come through clean energy like renewables and any of the above that are clean, including nuclear.
Here's a question for you. You know, there was this awful story the other day about the shootings of lawmakers in Minnesota, and you are a really high-profile public figure in New York politics. I mean, you go to a million events. You're known for showing up everywhere. Have you taken any new precautions or thought about your own safety in doing that any differently since that Minnesota story?
Yeah, well, the House is currently working on an updated plan because of the violence. Let me say, there's no room at all for violence driven by on political terms. I think what happened in Minnesota was an intense bit of a denial of work that legislators have done. It was a outright attack on the politics of a situation, and I think that we need to make certain that as we update those guidelines, that they take into account the uptick in violent expression out there. And it's tragic that people have resorted to violence to make themselves heard.
Let's talk about some politics now. We're speaking after these Democratic primaries in New York State. There was one in Albany where Dorsey Appleers won the four-way mayoral election. What were your thoughts on that outcome?
Well, you know, I thought that her outcome was particularly strong in a four-way primary to come up with 50-some percent,
yeah,
I 52. Believe is what I heard. That's a particularly strong outcome. And I know that as a candidate, she was working very, very hard. And it's, you know, a new day. She set history by being the first person of color and first woman of color to now lead the city. And so you wipe the slate clean and you start anew and wish her well in that capacity. You know, it was a very competitive race. I know the candidates were all working hard, but to achieve what she did in a four-way was a very strong outcome.
As the congressperson for the city of Albany, what do you think its greatest needs are from the federal government?
Well, I think that certainly what I hear about is safety issues. You know, I think that can be addressed by simply adding to police presence. We had a COPS program, an acronym COPS, which was really initiated to provide resources to local government to put more police force into action. And I think that just presence, their presence, would go a long way to address safety. And I think it's something that we should work on here. I think that, you know, these programs have been cut back over time. I think in this budget, the president is reducing a lot of activity for safety with police presence. Again, a cold shoulder to local government, which is very much a thematic throughout this budget.
What about the New York City result? A lot of people expected former Governor Cuomo to complete a comeback, and he got a surprise from a state assemblyman, 33-year-old Zohran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist. And everyone's watching closely how his politics align with the larger Democratic Party right now. So what was your thought on the outcome in New York?
Well, I thought his candidacy was about some of the essentials, about rental costs, about housing costs, about food, about utilities. He was speaking to the essentials, and I think that's what is number one in the mind of our constituents. These, you know, this whole thing that we're dealing with right now with the federal budget, where healthcare costs would either be healthcare would either be denied or made much more expensive, is a real concern. I think that people want to know that their basics, their food bill, their grocery bill, their housing bill, rent or mortgage, their utilities are all made more doable. And I think that was a thematic that he struck on. He stayed with it, and it obviously attracted a lot of people. And I think he inspired a lot of young people to get out there and vote.
This is our first time talking since Lieutenant Governor Delgado made it official that he will challenge Governor Hochul in next year's race. Where are you on that? Are you with Hochul or Delgado or undecided?
Undecided. I know both. I've worked with both here in Washington, and I know they both have great skills. But, you know, as we go forward, the thought I have that is major in my thinking is that this budget, hopefully we make it much better, but the forces of the presidency are going to really work his party to pass this. If that happens, we need people sitting in governor's chairs that are extremely compassionate, that are sensitive and willing to work to provide for the essentials again. And healthcare being prime amongst them, along with nutrition, grocery bills. You know, I want someone that will stand up for these essentials, work with Washington in a partnership. I think that's essential right now. Our governors need to really implement the damage challenge that's coming to them. They need to implement within their state budgets the kind of compassionate response to the basic human needs that people in their respective states require.
Well, do you think that Governor Hochul has done that? I mean, do you think she's met the moment?
Well, I noted that in the polling, you know, her numbers are starting to rise. I think that, you know, it's a tough job. And, you know, I think as you work your way through it, you get to understand better how to move across the finish line, the things that are required. But again, you know, I think... you know, that choice is going to be left to the voters, and we're almost back into that primary season again. It's amazing how one ends and the other starts very quickly.
It never stops.
No.
But you know, looking at everyone on this show, I mean, we talked to a lot of Democrats because of our location here in the Northeast. They've all been pointing to the midterms, the 2026, as a chance for a reset for, you know, some accountability on the Trump administration. So what do you think is a better message for your party in the next election as compared to in 2024?
I think our party needs to, again, emphasize what was accomplished during the Biden years. We really grew the economy. We had the best comeback of any industrialized nation from COVID. We had many, many programs in place to start driving an innovation economy, a clean energy economy. We were building research efforts that was really enabling us to compete effectively with China and other nations in the global economy. This is a major setback. They're clawing back a lot of the programs and the funds. They're, again, placing many, many families at risk with what's being done in this budget. I think we need to show compassion. We need to show common sense. We need to speak to the essentials of nutrition, of grocery bills, of utilities, of housing costs, housing opportunities. We need to advance programs that will address the housing stock in this country, which is anywhere from 4 to 4.5 million short. So these are the things that we can address to middle-income communities, middle-income households who want nothing more than to live the American dream. And at times, it's made it, this administration is making it extremely difficult.
That's all the time we have for this round with New York Congressman Paul Tonko, a Democrat from the 20th District. Congressman Tonko, we're so grateful for your time as always, and we are looking forward to the next one.
Okay, well, I appreciate what the station does to inform the people, and you're right in there fighting for it. So thank you so much.